So nice to have you back, Richard.
Thank you very much, Nima. Glad to be here.
Let's get started with the latest discussion, or we can call it some sort of talk between Jeffrey Sachs and John Mearsheimer, in which they had some sort of difference when it came to China, because whenever they were talking about Middle East or even in Ukraine, they were totally in line with each other. But when it came to China, two different opinion. Jeffrey Sachs was in favor of having understanding China and getting along with China, and John Mearsheimer in favor of containing China, even militarily. What's your take?
Yeah, well, you know, I admire John Mearsheimer. I think he is willing more than most people like him. And by that, I mean professional political scientists in American universities or European universities, both in and out of academic work, policy people and so on. In fact, partly because there's so much movement between the university and the government that having a critical perspective in the academic world becomes rarer and rarer. And I can assure you, having spent my life in American universities, I know what I am talking about. Up and coming young professors across the social sciences think about getting invited to Washington, or for that matter, overseas to capitals in other countries as advisors of one kind or another. It's very good for your resume. It usually pays better than academic life does, and it's full of prestige and recognition in the media. So it is very, you don't want to say or do anything that would deny you invitations. Very obvious all around us. I remember my professors in the universities I attended. I would say a good third of the time they either had just come back from doing some governmental work in Washington, or they were preparing to go to do that kind of work. They certainly talked in class to us as students because they knew it would impress us that they had been at a meeting of the Secretary of Defense, or they had been, et cetera, et cetera. It's very incestuous in a certain way. And what it does is it mutes criticism. All of that is by way of saying that none of that worked with John Mearsheimer. This is an independent thinking, a hard-nosed, you know, they call themselves the realist school. I have no idea what that means, or other than a way of putting down other people for being quote-unquote unrealistic, which is sort of childish. But in any case, I admire what he has to say, and I think he has been a very, very good voice on two subjects, the war in Ukraine and the war in the Middle East, Gaza and Israel. He has not shied away from talking about it. And his earlier research on the power of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States remains absolutely fundamental if anyone wants to understand that issue, other than somebody for whom Zionism is a religion. That's another matter, but for them, no, it doesn't do anything for them. But for everybody else, this helps you understand how and why the United States is being drawn into that war by the Israelis in this case. So that was fine. When it comes to China, look, I have no idea. He would be the first one to say, I think, that the so-called containment approach, which really comes out of World War II, containment was the word, I believe, credited to George Kennan, who was the leading political science guru, how to deal with Russia. You were going to contain Russia. This was the language, which in my view was pure ideological cover. And it was cover for the creation of a network of military bases, currently numbering somewhere between 700 and 800 military bases around the world that the United States maintains at enormous expense. It was said that this was necessary to contain Russia or to contain communism when that was seen as some sort of Russian maneuver, communism as the evil ideological master of whatever was being done by the Soviet Union as the home base of this expanding evil empire, to quote Ronald Reagan. And you had to contain this evil empire. This language was wonderful because it's language that says the United States establishes military bases for defensive reasons. In other words, the military bases are like NATO. They are a defensive institution. They are a defensive expenditure. Therefore, you don't have to ask or answer the question, to what extent is all of this the enforcement of the American empire? In my judgment, it is at least as much an empire enforcement mechanism as it ever was a defensive mechanism. The notion that the United States, after World War II, was in danger of a war perpetrated by Russia is ridiculous. I mean, and by the way, Mearsheimer would be the first to tell you that. Mearsheimer understands that Russia, in part, collapsed in 1989 because it tried to maintain an arms race with a country 10 to 20 times richer than itself. It couldn't do it. You cannot maintain military parity, let alone fight a war, a proxy war against the United States in Afghanistan, when the country you're fighting against has a GDP 10 times or 20 times yours. That's as hopeless as Ukraine defeating Russia. That's ridiculous. Even with the West's support, that isn't working out. But as a war, it's ridiculous because of the imbalance between the two. Yes, I've read the story of David and Goliath, and I understand under some weird circumstances, you could win if you're little against the big one. But that's not the normal outcome. The normal outcome is exactly what we're seeing. And the United States, however, had a wonderful defensive story to tell that allowed enormous sums of taxpayer money to be used to pay for an empire that the private sector wanted but didn't want to pay for. So how did the private capitalists get to secure markets for what they sell, get to secure origin of inputs they have to bring in, food, clothing, raw materials that have to come from outside the United States, many of them crucial, can't build a jet engine, for example, here in the United States without all kinds of components that come outside because we don't have them here. This is not a minor matter. So the way all of this was worked out was by having a vast story told of endangerment. The Russians endanger us. That's why I keep repeating right now, when the same game is being played again, Mr. Putin wants to take over Europe. There's no evidence. As Mearsheimer says over and over again, there is no evidence that he wants this. He sat by when NATO expanded to the Baltic states in the north, to Poland, to what was Czechoslovakia, to Romania. He said, you can't go beyond here. You know, not all here. He's already given away most of the what was Eastern Europe. But it's the story that Americans have always, and maybe this is the best way to tell the story. Americans have always needed to justify their own behavior by doing what psychologists call projection, projecting onto others what they are doing. This first came to me when I visited a little village here in the United States, in Massachusetts. It has a name, Deerfield. Deerfield was a little village in colonial America when it was part of Britain. And it was populated by the early British who came and settled. And where they settled was in an area populated by local indigenous tribes of people who had been living here for many centuries. I walked through the village, which has been reconstructed to look like a colonial village, so tourists come and look at it. That's what I was doing, tourist. And the little signs that explained each house had in common the following language. On such and such a date in 1641, the savages attacked us. And we defeated them, and we hid in the basement, and then the next house, the savages. And I'm saying to myself, this is magnificent. These people come 3,000 miles across the ocean, take the land away from these people, push them away, and then refer to them as savages. It's you who are savage. You came, you took. They didn't come to Europe. You came to them. You took their land. You ate their animals. You fished their water. I mean, who's the savage? Did you offer them help? No. Did you offer them some compensation? No. But they're the savage. The United States has this in its DNA. It's built in. So we are always surrounded by danger. By savages, not human beings, not other people. No, because that would be dangerous because then, you know, why are we treating them the way? So they can't be people, they are savages. So Mr. Putin isn't a leader trying to figure out how to keep his society together. No, savage. And we have lots of intelligent people writing articles as if they were psychiatrists for this man, giving us thumbnail description. I mean, you know, it's childish. It's very childish behavior, immature behavior. Anyway, if the Russians can't be portrayed as the savages, and Mearsheimer doesn't do that, then I hope I'm not being unfair to him, but if you're right, I didn't pick all that up from I didn't look at the whole talk he had with Jeffrey Sachs. But if he did what you say he did, then that would be my guess, that there has to be some enemy. And if it isn't the Russians, well, who then is it? Right? If you're some people, you could actually imagine, just showing how childish you are, that it is the North Koreans. You know, at that point, I realize I'm in the presence of people with whom further argument is pointless. But China makes more sense because it's big. But, you know, all I can do is to remind everyone, China's number one priority after Mao, for sure, but maybe even before. But after Mao, their priority has to develop themselves to stop being one of the poorest countries on earth and to become a modern, developed economy. The Chinese have that priority in common with most countries on this planet, in Asia, Africa, Latin America, Eastern Europe, and you name it. Okay? The difference between China and all those other countries is that China has done a better job of doing that than they have. So that China is now a serious economic competitor of the United States. The GDP of the United States, about $24 trillion. The GDP of China, 18. Nobody else is in the race. They are the two horses furthest down the race. That's the reality. The rest is make-believe. These are the two. And the United States is having a hard time because for a century it had no such competitor. The GDP of Russia is $1.5 to $2 trillion, not 24. There is no economic competition from Russia. There never was. That's an illusion of the West needing a dangerous enemy to justify its own problems and how it chose to solve them. Not very admirable behavior, but that's what we got. The Chinese are real. And so maybe what Mr. Mearsheimer means, if he were here with us, and I'd be glad to meet with him if you ever wanted to set that up, would be to talk about whether what he means is that China is something that Russia never was, and that therefore we ought to sit down to work out with China how we are going to live together. I want to remind people that in the history, both of the world and of economics, we have often had what are called duopolies. That's not a monopoly, that's one. And it's not an oligopoly, that's several. It's two. It's a duopoly. For example, here in the United States, for a long time, we basically had two automobile companies, General Motors and Ford. That was a duopoly. And I could give you many other industries where things got concentrated, not so there was only one. For example, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, was a monopoly until it was broken up. Then it was an oligopoly, you know, six or seven. But it could have been a duopoly with just two. It never got to that point. The automobile industry did. And, you know, I could go on. Well, we have a United States and China. In the past, duopolies have sometimes gone to war against one another. One of them was then destroyed, leaving the other one as a monopoly. Well, it's a little different with the United States and China because we had a monopoly. That was the United States, the empire. Then we gradually saw the emergence of a China to become a duopoly. And now the question is, are they going to go to war and resolve the conflict by going back to one of them, one or the other? Or do we get together to work something out? And that has happened sometimes too. So it's not outside the realm of possibility, but you have to admit that you have this issue before you can solve it. Every solution presumes that we have an agreed sense, roughly, of what the problem is. You know, if you join a self-help organization, one of the things you're required to do publicly is to say, well, I'm joining this organization because I'm an alcoholic, or I'm a this, or I had that problem. because admitting and facing the problem is necessary to achieving a solution. And it certainly is that in world affairs. At this point, we have nothing but the United States trying to contain China. You know, it's laughable. The United States has been trying to contain China now for at least 2 decades, probably longer, if all of it was understood, but at least the last 2 decades, you know, and very openly and aggressively under Trump. It began with Obama too, but Trump and Biden, trade wars, tariff wars, you know, the American Navy in the South China Sea, suddenly rediscovering the Taiwan issue as if that hadn't been put to bed decades ago. It's brought back to life. It's not the Chinese Navy here. It's not the Chinese Navy protecting the independence of Puerto Rico from the... It's we are over there. Let's remember, Ukraine is on the border of Russia, not the border of the United States. It's on, and Taiwan is on the border of, is part of China and so forth. So these are transparent efforts, and they don't work. They never worked. China has had a goal, as I said earlier, to become a richer, less poverty-stricken country. They've been working at it for the last 40 to 50 years, nonstop, top priority. That's what the Communist Party wants. That's what their government prioritizes. And that's the economy they've set up. And they've been very successful. Very, very successful. Every time I say that, I get emails from people who are angry at me for supporting authoritarian government. I haven't said a word about their government in terms of whether it's authoritarian or not, or how authoritarian. That's another discussion. I'm perfectly willing to have that discussion, but I'm not asking anyone to endorse or support or vote for anything about the government of China. I'm an economist describing what they have done. They have uniquely organized their economy so that it is roughly one half private capitalist enterprise, more or less like Western Europe, North America, Canada, Japan. They have the other half of their economy as a state-owned and operated enterprise system, more or less like the Soviet Union. That's a hybrid. It's not like the Soviet Union because it gives an enormous space to private capitalist enterprise, both Chinese and foreign. They've allowed American and European and Japanese and Canadian, they're all there. Okay, it's hybrid. It's not like the United States, it's a huge state sector. It's not like the Soviet Union, huge private sector. And then it's unique because it has a powerful government supervising, coordinating, and a Communist Party watching it all. Wow. A very interesting way of doing things. Does it have political consequences? Of course. Does it shape their civil liberties? And yes, yeah, we can talk about it. That's absolutely reasonable to put on the table. But it doesn't make go away what has happened. In the early 70s, the President Nixon and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, my teacher at Harvard when I was a student, went to China because they could see that capitalists from everywhere else in the world were making a big money in China. They wanted Americans to have that opportunity too. Plus, American corporations were telling them, go over there and open it up for us, which they did, because that's what they do. They're the people who do that for the big corporations. They always have. Nixon's career is that. And Kissinger put a nice academic face on it. They went there in order to what? Open China to business, which went to China in large flow ever since, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the first decade of this century. Corporation after corporation moved to China because its wages were much lower than here in the United States, and because the market was large and growing. By comparison, the United States had much higher wages, and the market wasn't growing. We have in this country what economists call a mature market. Okay, put whatever nice word you want on it. In business school, young, aspiring business women and men are told, if you want to make a good career in business, go to where the wages are low and the market is growing. And so they all listen, got their A, and went to China to do all that. And they've been doing it there ever since. Does private capitalism get some of the credit for China's spectacular growth? Yes, of course it does. Does the public sector run by the government? Of course it does too. They together achieved this incredible economic growth. And it is incredible. Here's a little statistic I try to mention because it ruffles feathers in a way that makes people remember. We have no record in the history of the human race comparable to the economic development achieved by the People's Republic of China since their revolution. For everybody who wants to tell me about how communism didn't work, I look at them with befuddlement. What are you talking about? What are you talking? Do you mean that what was in Russia isn't there anymore and failed? And then my response is, they call it socialism, not communism. USSR stands for Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. They wouldn't have picked that name if they wanted us to believe it was communism. You call it communism. They never did. And ditto the Chinese. So what are you talking about? And once we can get you over the absurd nonsense you speak, because you're either ignorant about what the story was or you need ideologically to rewrite history. Communism is the name of the party. Communism is something the party claims it hopes one day to achieve in some nebulous future we may or may not get to. And we can talk about that, but we can't talk about what they did as communism because that's not what they were doing. They were erecting a socialism. China calls it socialism with Chinese characteristics. Russians would have answered yes, and we have socialism with Russian character. And that's fine. I have no problem with that. But what they are reasonably measurable by is what they set themselves out to accomplish. What was your goal? We wanted to become a rich and powerful country. What have you achieved? We are a rich and powerful country. Wow. And you did that with what? With 1.4 million people. Billion people. You went from one of the poorest countries on earth to a competitor of the United States, and you did it in one generation? You know, a comparable development took centuries in Europe. Took at least a century and a half in the United States. They did it in 40, 50 years. That's amazing what they did. They may have paid a terrible price of all kinds, and I'm more than happy to discuss it. But communism is great, works no place. I can't tell you how many esteemed professors, among others, I have had to debate who say nonsense like this. And they say it with the comfort and the solidity and the casualness of something we really all know, sort of with the same spirit as tomorrow the sun will come up. We may not see it because of the clouds, but I'm confident the sun will come up. And we all nod, yeah, we're all confident the sun will come up. I find it a wonderful testimony to the power of ideology, that the anxiety about socialism and communism handles itself by having all these people say to one another, socialism never works. And the rest of us look at them in the same way that we look at a candidate for president who is really agitated by the fact that a small, dark-skinned immigrant community is eating pets. I hope I have not said anything to offend my fellow professor Mearsheimer, whose work I genuinely do admire. I have learned from him. I appreciate it. With Jeffrey Sachs, it's a little bit different. He did terrible things. In the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, he went over there and administered an austerity program about which I believe he has now gotten deep, deep regrets. And I commend him, if I'm right. If he has those regrets, he should. That was some terrible, terrible things were done there. And so now he compensates, or he offsets, by taking a much more progressive position on these kinds of subjects than he used to.
Richard, when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, we have two military-industrial complex fighting each other. The Russian military-industrial complex, which is the Soviet Union military-industrial complex, still under the control of the government, the same way it was before. And the other is the military-industrial complex of the United States, capitalist military-industrial complex.
Right.
And these two are fighting each other, and the United States is not capable, because of BRICS, to put with those sanctions to destroy the Russian economy. And the economy is working, that they can feed the military industrial complex. Can we say that this, even if they, in those days with the Soviet Union, what was the reason that Soviet Union collapsed? It was because of these problems, these type of some sort of sanctions, or the problem that Soviet Union had within its system?
Well, let me respond to several things. I think the difference between the military-industrial complex in the Soviet Union and that in the United States is minimal. I think they are very similar. I think they work in similar ways. There is a military leadership that is responsible for mobilizing the Army and Navy and all of that, and operating its equipment and assessing and fighting wars. And then there is the private sector, which produces the guns and the ships and the planes and the uniforms and all the rest needed by the military. Each of them needs the other. You can't have a military without the production. You can't have that production unless they can sell it to the military. And so they become a military-industrial complex. And the lines between them become more and more blurry. You have people moving, executives from the companies become leaders of the military and vice versa. You see that in both societies. Generals become executives. Executives become military ministers or deputy ministers, all of that. This is a merger, and it is a phenomenon there as it is here. And that became only, that was true before 1989, and it is true afterwards. Before 1989, it was state enterprises that had to work out their relationship with the military. Now it's private enterprises who work out the relationship. In the early years, it was the same individuals who had simply changed their uniform and their outfit from civilian to military and so on, or had joined the Communist Party or unjoined it, as the case may be. Now, as to why the Soviet Union fell, well, my colleague Stephen Resnick and I wrote a book called Class Theory and History, Capitalism and Communism in the USSR. We wrote that book, published it in the year 2002. It's been translated into many languages and so on. It is the attempt from a Marxist perspective to account for the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the reason we wrote that book was because everything we read were accounts of that from an anti-Marxist perspective. And basically for them, it was a kind of I told you so book, that there is something intrinsic in socialism, or if they don't understand, as a point I made earlier, in communism, it doesn't work. Just like there were all those books and articles in the 1990s in which the author would say something like, in the 20th century, there was a struggle between capitalism and socialism, and now with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's clear capitalism won, socialism lost. And out of that then grew this habit that I talked about a few minutes ago. Well, socialism doesn't work. As if Russia and Eastern Europe were the only places it had ever been tried. As if the People's Republic of China, in which more people live than in all the other parts of global socialism combined, didn't count. China disappeared. You know, it's when you need an argument to work and you've got really troublesome facts, you make the facts go away. I mean, that's all that this is. So we decided to write a book. And to give you the basis of this book, published by Routledge, a global publisher based in England, the book is still available. You can get it, Resnick and Wolf, Class Theory and History, if you're interested. We make the case that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a collapse of its internal class structure. And we show how that happened. It's a, you know, it's a full-length book. It talks about the Soviet factory. It talks about the Soviet family. It talks about planning. It goes through the role of the government as opposed to the non-governmental sectors of the economy. By the way, there always were huge sectors of the economy that were not owned and operated by the government, that were in effect private enterprises. You know, the nonsense that we had to wade through, it was a wonderful lesson for us that the Cold War had produced an immense industry of nonsense, of propaganda. I don't know Russian, so I can't tell you if the on the Soviet side they had the same. They may have, for all I know. But I do know that in French, German, English, 95% of what was written was ideological, propagandistic. No, bad, bad, bad. They are bad, 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 bad. We are very, very good. They are bad, bad. After a while, repetitious in the way that ideologues debate with one another. But we weren't interested. We were interested in what is going on. And so we wrote a book. And in our view, it's complicated, but in our view, we don't think they ever broke in Russia from the capitalist model of industrial organization. And what I mean by that is the employer-employee model of how you run a business, whether it's a factory, an office, or a store. The Russians did it. They just put governmental, so it's a group of state officials are the board of directors, or a group of state officials run the company. Sure, okay, that's for us state capitalism, because the capitalist is in the state, is part of the state apparatus, rather than being a private non-state citizen. Okay, that's an interesting difference. I don't deny that that makes a difference. You get different outcomes if you organize it privately or statewide. But for me, that's not what socialism is about. For me, I get this from Marx. Marx's whole Das Kapital is about how, in a capitalistically organized business with employer versus employee, where the employer buys the labor power, hires the worker produces a surplus, capitalist receives it as a profit, and the system works around maximizing the profit of enterprise, that's for me capitalism. And I don't care whether the capitalist who runs it is a private citizen or a government official. I don't care in terms of whether it's capitalist or not. I put an adjective because it's important. This is private capitalism and this is state capitalism. And once Steve Resnick, my co-author, and I, once we worked that out, we were then struck, of course, once you figured something like that out, to discover that no less a leader than Vladimir Lenin, in a very famous speech a year or so before he died in 1923, so 4 years into the revolution, maybe five, he referred, after 4 or 5 years, he referred to what they had accomplished, the Bolsheviks. "We've accomplished," he said, "state capitalism. Now we have to undertake, having captured the government, having established state capitalism, we have to undertake the process of moving the economy to post-capitalism." And what did he mean? Well, he says all the industries have to become co-ops. No more employer-employee. That's capitalism. State capitalism, in our case, in the Soviet Union. But it's capitalism. We want equality, democracy. One worker, one vote. We decide democratically what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the results. That's a democrat. That's what socialism is aiming at. Otherwise, we have made a revolution to go from private capitalism to state capitalism. And I'm glad we did that, says Lenin. But that's only the beginning. If we stop there, here comes a danger. If we stop there, we have betrayed the revolutionary's goal, which was to go much further. That issue, do we stay at state capitalism or do we go further? That issue is fought out right now everywhere where there is socialism. In 100 little moments, in lots of different ways of thinking and acting, that issue is being debated and fought out. Whereas in the West, the hostility to everything means that they're not aware that that's the issue, let alone that it's being fought out. There is the same blindness to where socialism actually is in the world that you have in the West, the same blindness to the decline of the American empire. They cannot face it. And you know, it's not so unusual. When empires decline, the people caught up in the decline have to go through quite a struggle and period to get beyond denying it, to get to the point of saying, yeah, it is happening. Now, what do we do about it? How do we manage it? And of course, the risk, I'm not shying away from it. The risk is there that when you have Russia, China with nuclear weapons and the United States and with nuclear weapons, that these people will destroy the whole world rather than work out their differences. That's, you know, that's what's in the mind of, I would argue, 9/10 of the people of Ukraine. Why is this happening to us, they ask. Why isn't Zelensky and his people on the one hand, and Putin and his people on the other, or the United States and whoever the key players here are, why aren't they sitting down? As we all know, they eventually will. Why don't they save a lot of destruction, save a lot of lives, save a lot of horrible suffering? Do it now. Don't wait. And the same in Gaza or in the West Bank or in Lebanon now. It's just an enormous part of my family of origin was French and German. An enormous part of them were killed in World War II. I know because my grandmother told me 8 million stories, and my mother and father told me 8 million stories, and I was the child who watched their facial expressions, their tears. I know what war means. My fellow Americans don't, except those that have been in the military. They know. And in case you don't know, let me assure my audience, we have an amazing problem of the mental health and suicides of our soldiers. They are traumatized by what we put them through. And I'm not speaking of what happens to the people in the countries where we send these. That's a whole nother horror. But to undertake a war means, in my mind, that you have no idea what you are doing. And since I know that the World Wars I and II were largely fought in Russia, that the major deaths were Russian, I kind of know they know what the risk of war means. But they're playing with Americans who don't. And that's part of what's going on here too, which of course the American media cannot explore because it might end up making Americans culpable. So we don't hear that. But everybody should understand, because you don't hear it doesn't mean it isn't there.
Richard, just to wrap up this session, in your opinion, with what's going on, yet you've mentioned what's going on in Ukraine, do you see the policymakers in the United States capable of learning of what has been going on in Ukraine or even in the Middle East to not go and have the same kind of conditions with China?
No, I have no confidence. I have no confidence that they have that ability, or I see no tendency among them to go in that direction. Here's the irony of where people like me are. I cannot help noticing that the American Pentagon, the military center of American strategic thinking, is constantly telling this government that it cannot go to war with Russia, that this is a impossible course of action. So then the problem then becomes that you have political authorities, and this has happened before, it's not the first time, not the first time in the United States and not the first time globally. The political authorities want to go to war, but their own military tells them, we're not ready, we're not prepared, we're not sure what the outcome will be. If we fight a nuclear war, we risk everything. If we fight a non-nuclear war, we may well be defeated. Therefore, we're not ready. Maybe we can get ready, if even that makes sense, but we're not. And so they're held back, not by a popular uprising. Because Americans don't know from their own experience what war is, you don't have here the kind of peace movements you do get in other countries, particularly those who have a war memory built in. But you can have a war blocked by the military telling you they're not ready. They're not ready to do it. And by the way, not ready is a very complicated judgment. People should not be naive. It is not only about how many missiles you have or how many rounds of howitzer shells you can put into effect. It also is the military. Give me an example. When the Supreme Court killed affirmative action a few months ago, it carved out an exemption for the military. They can go ahead and do it. Why? Because our military now is, 40 to 50% black and brown people. If you have white supremacy emerging politically, you are creating unbelievable tension inside your military. These people are not going to work together. They're not going to trust each other. You can't, you have, your military dissolves not in the battle, but in the internal politics. They're very, very worried. The white people the military gets come from the same communities, not all together, but heavily, that are full of white supremacy. Are they bringing that with them into an army that has not only, you know, has black and brown people in it, but is typically fighting black and brown people? I mean, all of that's wrapped up here. They're not ready. And they're acutely aware we lost the other wars. You know, we lost them. We're losing. If you see in Ukraine where the border is, it's moving in one direction, west. That's away from Russia. That's what they want, the Russians. That's what they're getting, the Russians. Not just Crimea, but the four areas in the whole Donbass and so forth. It just, and yet there is this crazy, our Secretary of State, Mr. Blinken, is willing to have conversations about how to assess Mr. Zelensky's plan for victory. This is lunacy. This is just, okay. This is popular theater for a society whose government cannot risk admitting to its own people what is actually going on. And these are all signs of decline. These are not signs of strength. That's the rationale. We have to show we're strong. You don't. You show you're weak. You just don't get it. And when you get the polling results and they show that Mr. Putin is much more popular than any politician in the West, you know, you pretend it doesn't matter. Okay. I mean, I don't believe in polls either, but there it is. And it's been true throughout the war. No one in Russia seems to mind what Mr. Putin is doing. They think he's doing a great job. Large parts of the world do too. But then again, these are the same people who don't see the problems and think they'll go away. And you know, again, final point repeated. When empires decline, one of the ways people cope with it is to pretend it isn't happening. That's why it's often possible to date the end of an empire, even though that's a slow process that happens usually over decades. There is something. There's that moment when, having denied it, you finally get to such an explosive moment that no denial is possible. That's when the barbarians or the savages come roaring across the gate into your cities, and then everybody realizes, oh, the empire has collapsed. No, it collapsed years before, but you have been busy hoarding, if you're rich enough to have something to hoard, pushing the costs onto your fellow citizens, driving them to anger and bitterness as a result, splitting the country apart. All of those things are what made it possible for those folks to come into your city that last week. But that's not when your empire collapsed. Same thing in the United States. It's the inability to see and the greed to hold on because you don't see yourself as part of this process. Someday we'll have the leaders who will say to corporations and the rich, here are your choices. Give up half of what you have to the rest of the society. Because if you don't, you won't have anything to give anyone at all. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Richard, for being with us today.
I hope I did not end on a difficult note. On the other hand, I blame you, Nima. You encourage us to be honest and say what we have in our minds. So that's what I've done.
You did a great job. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.